Thanks, Brother Ryan, for the reading. And without further delay, we'll introduce our speaker. And the topic is going to be the nations were angry and development of the Gorgian-like system. And Brother Jim Carley.
You might want to sit in the audience just so you can see the screen.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Brother Chairman. Good evening, brethren and sisters and young people. This is an important aspect of our weekend because we're going to be talking tonight about three things where we can clearly see Bible prophecy being fulfilled. Those three things are going to be, one, the rise of a Gogian-style dictatorship in Russia, and that's why we read Habakkuk chapter 2. You might have said to yourself, why would he get that unpleasant chapter to be read? There's a reason. The second thing we want to talk about is what I call the crescent of crisis. Sudan, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, crescent of crisis. We want to see what's happening there, what has been happening there for some considerable time, and see its relationship to Bible prophecy and to our future. And thirdly, I want to talk briefly about the financial crisis that has gripped our world and especially this nation. I want to tell you where that's going to head scripturally. We can be pretty sure about it. So they're the three things I want to address. But I want to start first of all with this matter of the rise of a Gogian-style dictatorship in Russia. Now this Time magazine dates back to 1979, in which the Russian bear, communist then, was looking down upon the crescent of crisis. See where it goes from? Ethiopia, Sudan, right around to India. So they did have some concept. Not biblical, they had some concept that something was happening there of great importance to our world. Well, things died down, didn't they? Things changed. Communism fell. But we're back to the same thing again. The difference now is that the Russian bear is no longer communist. He's Gogian. And that's the important thing. He's Gogian. There was a dictatorship there in 1979, but not the form that's required by Scripture. And Habakkuk 2 is going to tell us a lot about that style of dictatorship. Well, this was said by a retired military analyst, Major General Alexander Vladimirov, once in the Russian army, as saying back in 2007, we need to show everyone that the era of humiliation and collapse associated with the 1990s is gone and won't come back. We should not join any dubious alliances or comply with treaties of dubious origin, read NATO. Our task and our right is to follow our security strategy precisely, and they've done precisely that. For while the world, this is 2007, while the world was engaged in the fun of the Olympic Games in Beijing in China, the Russians pushed south into Georgia. They always choose the right time, don't they? When people are watching the screen of fellows jumping over this or running around circles. They choose the right time. They did it again last year. The Russian bear pushed south. Now let's just step back a little bit. Let's go back to the old Iron Curtain days. This is what came down in 1989. The Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain, and Russia in those days was called the USSR, the United Soviet Socialist Republics. It was a country enormous in size, down through here, down through Georgia, over here, had all of these stan states as part of it, the Turkmenistans, the Uzbekistans, the Kazakhstans, the Kyrgyzstans, and so on. All of that was part, right over to the Aleutian Straits, the Vladivostok and other places. That was the massive Russian Empire under communism. But it all fell apart, didn't it? In 1992, when the Russian Communist Party fell apart and their politics fell apart, they went back to here. So Ukraine and Belarus and Latvia became the frontier states. They had what they called the CIS, the Commonwealth of Independent States. What really was the case was that Russia was confined now to this area here. Okay? That wasn't going to fulfill Bible prophecy, was it? And we had some people saying, well, there you go. There you go. You people who read the pioneers, what about it now, eh? We knew, didn't we, those of us who read the pioneers, that it would come back. And it has. And it will. So here's Georgia, one of the independent states, sought closer ties with the West, sought to go into capitalism. Russia, last year, invaded Georgia. They did so because they came in support of the South Ossetians and the Abkhazians, who sought autonomy from the Georgians down here in Tbilisi. And the Russians used that desire for autonomy by these two peoples as an excuse to come in on Friday the 8th of August 2008 and to make life for the Georgians very difficult indeed. Why would that happen, do you think? Well, you see, this just so happens to be an area. It's been in the news a lot in recent times. You all heard of Chechnya, haven't you? Okay? Have you heard of a town called Beslan? Beslan is over here, not that far from Chechnya, and it was Chechen rebels who took a school in Beslan in 2004 and killed 340-odd people, most of them children. Remember that one? So it's a region that's known a little bit of this stuff, violence and all sorts of evils. Why should this be happening in this area? Well, you see, Ezekiel 38 verse 6 says this, that amongst the confederate powers that join with Gog in the latter days to come down upon the mountains of Israel is a power called the House of Togarmah, with all the bands thereof. So who is this Togarmah? Well, according to Keelan Dalish, commentators from the 1800s, Togarmah is the name of the Armenians, who are still called the House of Thorgom, or the Torkamatsi, today. So the House of Togarmah are the Armenians. Well, there's a few other peoples around here as well, but why house? Why does it say the house? Why doesn't it say the House of Gomer, for instance? Or the House of Persia? Why house? Well, you see, back in 1918 to 22, the Turks tried to eradicate their eastern lands of Armenians. And there was a genocide, at least that's what the Armenians claim. And several hundred thousand people were massacred. And so the Armenians were scattered. They went south, they went east, they went north. They've been spread around, these people, the House of Togarmah. They don't belong to one little land confined by a border. Armenians are spread all over. And that's why this is very interesting. There's Georgia right there. And what Russia has done is to start the process of bringing under its control the House of Togarmah. There are other peoples here too as well, aren't there, in eastern Turkey and northern Iraq, called the Kurds. That's actually the modern name for the Chaldeans. So they're around too. And they'll probably get involved. Seeing that we just read a chapter that talks about Chaldeans, we'll come back to that. Well, what is happening? In 2007, it was reported on August the 24th that the Russian president met the Armenian president in a place called Sochi, which just happens to be a few miles west of the border between Russia and Georgia. Well-chosen site. And they talked about energy cooperation, but something more important. Meanwhile, a shipment of some 300 tons of Russian military equipment removed from the Russian military base at Batumi in Georgia, because Russia's relationships with Georgia were not good, was due to reach Armenia on August the 23rd. So Russia is arming Armenia, the House of Togarmah. And they're going to eventually, of course, completely absorb Georgia into their massive image empire. So these little things that sometimes can pass by are part of an overall program. Now I want to talk about the dictatorship of Gog. Rotherham's translation of Ezekiel 38 verse 2 is, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, and I want you to notice what it says. In the authorized version it says, the land of Magog. Here it says, of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. The Amplified Bible is similar. Son of man, set your face against Gog, of the land of Magog. What's that telling us? It's telling us this. Gog is a dictator. The word means the one at the top. It speaks of an individual who establishes a dictatorship, who controls other peoples, but he happens to be, in his origins, of the land of Magog. Now, we'll talk about Magog a little later, but I want you to understand that the biblical Gog is of the land of Magog. Your speaker tonight is a brother of the land of Australia. Got that? I'm not an American. You can tell that by my accent. I just want you to understand that, because we're going to come back to that point and you're going to see how relevant that is to what I have to say. Now, Gog, of course, in his Bible, Gog is described by Unger in his Bible dictionary in these terms. He got it right. He was an apostate, but he got this one right. Ezekiel 38, 39, which deal with Gog, the prince, see, dictator, and Magog, his land, he's got that right, described the actual invasion of Palestine, as it was when he wrote it, now Israel, by a great northern confederacy ostensibly headed up by Russia. He's got that right. Prince of Rosh, the most ancient form of the name Russia. Scene depicts a gigantic outburst of anti-Semitism, etc., etc. So here we have a description of the Gogian dictator. We know something about him from Ezekiel 38, but we know a whole lot more about him from Habakkuk chapter 2. So I want you to come and join me in this chapter. Let's have a look at it. Let's analyse what this chapter contains. We need, first of all, to establish our context. What context are we in here? This is a prophecy written by Habakkuk at a time when the Chaldeans were about to descend into his land and sweep away God's people, Judah. He talks about an appointed time in verse 3. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Good words of exhortation and advice for us today. It will surely come. Verse 4, he speaks about two classes of people. Behold his soul, and he's talking about the Chaldean dictator who was to enter the land of Judah. Okay, so that's one character, the Chaldean dictator. His heart is lifted up, it's not upright in him. He's a man of pride, but here's the other class. The just shall live by his faith. That's you and me. It's the faithful in Judah at that time. The just shall live by faith. In verse 14, we know what the context is, don't we? The earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. In verse 20, Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Context? The invasion of the land of Israel by a dictatorship from the north, just like it happened in ancient times, in the days when Habakkuk wrote. But the culmination is the establishment of the kingdom of God. Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And if you didn't think that was right, tomorrow morning, God willing, we're going to read Habakkuk chapter 3. And Habakkuk 3 is a psalm detailing the march of the rainbowed angel. It tells us in precise detail the movements of Christ and the saints from Sinai to come to the sanctuary in Zion. So there's no doubt about the context. There's no doubt where our minds should be when we read Habakkuk chapter 2. Look for this happening today. It has a historical basis, of course. But this is about today. So let's have a look at the dictator of Habakkuk 2. What's he like? Well, we saw in verse 4 he was corrupt. This is the corrupt Chaldean oppressor of Yahweh's people. Verse 5, we read this. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as the grave, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied. But gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all peoples, as it should read. So he's noted for drunkenness. I don't need to remind you that Boris Yeltsin died in 2004 of cirrhosis of the liver, and that Russia loses hundreds of thousands of people every year to alcoholism. In fact, their birth rate is so low and their death rate is so high, they'll lose 45 million people in the next 20 years. 45 million of 248 million. They're going down the drain. Okay, so here we've got a drunken society. And pride. Find me a nation on earth. It's got more pride than Russia. Expansionism. Insatiability. And a dictatorship. A rigid dictatorship. Let's go on. Verse 6. Shall not all these take up a parable against him? That is, those nations who suffer at his hand. And a proverb saying, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Now I'm going to come back to that phrase, thick clay, in a moment. We're just going to carry on in this chapter. Verse 8. Here's the nature of this dictatorship. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, and all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land. And violence, ruthless in spoiling nations and cities and innocent people. Verse 9. He uses religion as a vehicle to hide and to justify his actions. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high. Nest on high. We're going to see in a moment that has to do with religion. That he may be delivered from the power of evil. He's above it. He's got religion on his side. Verse 12. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, establisheth a city by iniquity. So he builds his empire by fire and blood. And then we come to verse 15, that most unpleasant verse, together with verse 16. Woe to him that giveth his neighbour drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Do you know how Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia? He was made the head of the FSB, the old KGB, the secret police. He was made the head of the FSB in 1999. He was in office for a very short while, and Boris Yeltsin was in serious trouble in the last year or so of his presidency. His family, if not Yeltsin himself, had been fiddling the books in the Kremlin. They'd been creaming off billions, maybe millions, but certainly a whole lot of money was going into the pockets of the Yeltsin family. And Yeltsin, probably incorrectly from his perspective, appointed Yevgeny Primakov as Prime Minister of Russia. And Primakov, in this era of openness and democracy, was going to make a name for himself. He knew what was going on, so he appointed a prosecutor who would pursue the corruption in government. And the prosecutor uncovered much evidence that the Yeltsin family had their hand in the till. And Boris Yeltsin could feel the heat coming on. He was in serious trouble. He lifted up the phone to Vladimir Putin, head of the FSB, and said, Mr. Putin, can you help me, please? Explain to him the problem. Mr. Putin said, leave it to me, Boris. Relax. Vladimir Putin set up a safe KGB house close to the Kremlin. He put in it two ladies of dubious character, need I say more, filled the fridge with vodka, and arranged for the prosecutor, who was uncovering all the dirt on the Yeltsin family, to be in that house at a very strategic time, and filmed him. Videoed the goings on and then broadcasted on Russian television. What did I read in verse 15? Woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink, that puttest thy bottle to him and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. That man had his nakedness broadcast on Russian television. Next day, resigned, end of case. Boris Yeltsin safe, and Vladimir Putin next in line for the Russian presidency. That's how he came to power. Did you know that? Habakkuk chapter 2. I want to show you something about this man Putin in a moment. You're going to see a 14-minute video of a two-hour program. I've just taken 14 minutes. That's why this session's going to go a bit longer tonight. Hope you don't mind. You can sleep in the video, okay? We'll come to that. Now, verses 18 and 19. He's an image worshipper. What profiteth the graven image, that the maker thereof hath graven it? The molten image, and a teacher of lies, that the maker of his work trusteth therein, to make dumb idols. And it goes on like that. It's talking about image worshippers. Well, guess what? Putin, when he becomes president, had a very close relationship, like Yeltsin, with Alexei II, who, by the way, was German and was also for 40 years a KGB agent put inside the church to keep control in the communist era. Did you know that? He's died a few months ago. He's been replaced. But Putin said this: I consider it my sacred duty. He does this, of course, after he's kissed all the images that he can lay his lips on. I consider it my sacred duty to unite the people of Russia and to gather citizens around the clearly defined tasks and aims and to remember, you want an exhortation? Listen to this. Wouldn't this be great if Christadelphians could say this? To remember every minute of every day that we are one nation and we are one people. We have one destiny. Be nice if we could say that about the work of the truth, wouldn't it? He's dedicated and he's actually achieved his aim. You'll be surprised what I'm going to say about Putin a bit later on, so don't get ahead of me. Just wait. The image worshipper, Habakkuk chapter 2, he protects him. He's a crook. When he dies, they will screw him into the ground. He's that crooked. Richest man in Russia. He makes the Jewish billionaires look like Sunday school scholars. He's said to own between $50 and $60 billion US. Not that the US dollar's worth what it was. And the next best to him don't come anywhere near that. Did you know that in 2000, when he came to power, there were 19 billionaires in Russia and that 16 of them were Jews? He's outstripped them. So this man, he's a crook, and he hides behind religion. Exactly what Habakkuk 2 said. Let's go back to that phrase at the end of verse 6. This phrase down here, that ladeth himself with thick clay. This is about gathering unto him all nations. He's insatiable. He can't be satisfied. To him that increaseth that which is not his, he ladeth himself with thick clay. What does that mean? Does it mean the man gets hold of clay and smears it over himself? No. The word in the Hebrew means the weight of pledges. And what Russia is doing is to put other nations in their debt, to control them by controlling their supplies of gas. I mean here, liquid gas, not the stuff you put in your motor car over here. Gas that you heat your homes with, to run your factories with. So Russia has the greatest reserves of mineral resources of any nation in the world. It's especially rich in mineral fuels, containing the world's largest natural gas reserves, the second largest coal reserves, the eighth largest oil reserves, and is among the world leaders in the deposits of iron ore, asbestos, not that they want too much of that, zinc, nickel, cobalt, diamonds, potassium, lead, gold, platinum, uranium. Don't think I read silver there, but it's not a bad list, is it? And they're using those natural resources to grab hold of other powers. Russia currently supplies over 25% of Germany's gas requirements in a decade that will exceed 80%. And when you've got 80% of your gas supplies coming from Russia, you don't argue with it. I'm going to show you that. You don't argue with it. When they say, you will come with us, yes, sir, thank you. How many bags, sir? I'll do it. You don't argue with it. Russia has established a dictatorship that knows what it's doing. And it is lading itself with thick clay. It is putting other nations in their debt by weight of pledges. So the rise of this dictator in Russia has actually gone under the radar. Effectively under the radar. So what drives this obscure man? Notice, born in St. Petersburg. Just tuck that one away in your mind. What drives him? This man with that very friendly face. You could trust him with your family, I'm sure. Greatly underestimated by Russian oligarchs. by the internal CIS opposition, and there was much, by the European nations, and of course chiefly by the United States of America. What motivates him? Well, this is what motivates him: the fall of the Berlin Wall. He was working for the FSB, KGB, in East Germany in 1989, when the wall came down. And he described it as the greatest geopolitical disaster in history. Now that's big, isn't it? The greatest geopolitical disaster in history is the opinion of Vladimir Putin. And he said then that he was not going to rest until he reversed it. And that's exactly what he set out to do. Now I'm going to show you a movie. Just give me half a second to get this organized.
In March 2000, Vladimir Putin, an obscure ex-KGB man, is elected as president of Russia. What thoughts cross the new president's mind as he climbs the stairs to the throne of the Tsars? Is he thinking of his games on the banks of the Neva in Leningrad, now called St. Petersburg once more? Of when he was king of the gang in the communal apartment block where his family shared two rooms? Is he picturing the heroes of his youth like Yuri Gagarin, sensing the presence of the Tsars whose shadows linger within these walls? Or is his mind fixed on the mission he has set himself, to save Russia, whatever the cost, from the chaos left by his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin?
Patriotic and fascinated by Tsarist imperialism in his youth, Vladimir Putin was also deeply influenced by the Soviet regime. The country that has elected him is thirsty for a new hero who will revive national strength and pride. Even the memories of Stalin's purges seem obliterated by disillusion with the present. The Russian people are nostalgic for past glory.
A great president for the country that is obsessed with its own greatness and its own image. And, you know, I think Putin is using Khrushchev's car of 1956. It's a sign. I mean, in terms of PR, it's like, well, wait a minute. What do you mean? I'm using Khrushchev's car. I'm a descendant of his politics.
Really? Double it up? That's so much fun, we're going for another laugh.
30 years after dreaming of becoming a secret agent, Vladimir Putin has discreetly climbed all the steps which lead to power.
Владимир Владимирович Путин.
The KGB, the Russian Secret Service, now called the FSB, teaches him rigor and method, a system. His political mentor, President Yuri Andropov, gives him his vision of the role of the state and the organization of the economy. Posted to East Germany, he becomes a lieutenant colonel and encounters the world of business. The fall of the Berlin Wall and of the USSR see the birth of his mission to restore respect for his country and the world. A native of St. Petersburg, he owes his political career to its Democrat mayor, Anatoly Sobchak, and later to Boris Yeltsin. His apparent loyalty towards these men is at the core of his system. It is this loyalty that leads the oligarchs in Yeltsin's clan to propose him as a successor to serve their own economic and political interests. As Prime Minister, Putin makes Chechnya his battleground, proving his military leadership. The victory of his party, Unity, in the parliamentary elections confirms him as the legitimate successor to Boris Yeltsin.
Throughout all these years, Vladimir Putin has observed and analyzed the arcane mysteries of power, never openly showing any ambition to replace his superior. Today, he has reached his secret goal.
Who is Mr. Putin? If you try to be short, it's a story of corrupt KGB officer who found himself on as the head of one of the greatest countries in the world, and who is willing to do absolutely everything in his power to stay on top, no matter what cost.
Клянусь уважать и охранять права и свободы человека и гражданина, соблюдать и защищать Конституцию Российской Федерации.
Realize his teenage dream to be the hero who will save Russia and restore its might. His objectives are clear. Develop the strategic resources for the state, oil, gas, the media, other industries, increase military power, and renew the sense of national identity and pride amongst the Russian people. Putin owes much of his success to television. It is the first tool he needs to possess. The oligarchs, who are the owners of the media, have helped him construct his victory, and they are convinced that he will continue to serve them. But they have robbed the country. Yeltsin has been evinced. Now it is their turn to pay for their crimes. The new president uses tactics for his first move. He decides to operate through the state-owned energy giant Gazprom, which has important assets in the media.
So it's not a wonder that Mr. Putin, who came into power in 2000, obviously took this opportunity and, literally directly headed Gazprom himself, appointing his representative, Mr. Miller, as a formal CEO of this company. Mr. Putin literally makes decisions on important business transactions or important investment projects by himself. This means that he's in fact the CEO of Gazprom.
Gazprom is the perfect tool to attack Vladimir Kuzinski. The oligarch had fought against Putin's election through his TV station and was against the war in Chechnya. His station was financed by loans from the energy giant.
So all Putin actually did is demanded for his loan to be returned to Gazprom. And at that moment, financially and economically, Kuzinski was ruined, of course. And it was clear to everybody this move is political.
The rebel oligarch is incarcerated in June 2000 for embezzlement. The court allows him to leave the country provided he turns over the majority of his NTV stocks to Gazprom. Under the cover of the law and the fight against corruption, Putin has started to hunt down the enemy within and a campaign against the independent media. Boris Berezovsky, the oligarch who had helped Putin to become president, also begins to realize that the wind has changed. Kuzinski has fled. Berezovsky is the only oligarch who is not invited to the first meeting organized by Putin. For the remaining oligarchs, Putin announces it's business as usual, but politics are out. Putin is beginning to show what stuff he's made of. Berezovsky has considered him to be a mere pawn to serve his own interests. And for Putin, humiliation is a powerful incentive for cold and calculated revenge. Berezovsky's fate is strangely linked to an event that jeopardizes Vladimir Putin's own political career. In August 2000, 3 months after his investiture, the annual Navy exercises are to show the whole world that Russian military power is not to be underrated. But two mysterious explosions send the pride of the fleet, the nuclear submarine Kursk, to the floor of the Barents Sea. Putin refuses assistance from abroad and remains silent for several days. The 118 submariners on board perish in the depths. The Russian people are angry. The press accuses Putin of contempt for the families. Berezovsky, who still imagines he's the master of the situation, jumps at the opportunity to publicly denounce the president's incompetence.
After the Kursk case Putin definitely decides to take TV channel from Berezovsky, and that's when the open conflict between Berezovsky and Putin started.
Like his colleague, Kuczynski, Berezovsky is accused of embezzlement and flees the country to avoid jail.
Putin's idea of democracy does not allow for criticism of authority. 1 year after his arrival in power, Gazprom finalizes the takeover of NTV. Early one morning, armed men invade the television studios. When they arrive, the journalists discover that a team from the Kremlin has replaced them. Putin gives one warning, but if unheeded, he is pitiless.
The word for KGB mentality. The word is control. What you control is safe. What you don't control is a threat. So it means that you should try to control as many things as possible.
That is vertical. I mean, that you cannot be more vertical than that. And so, you know, he did what he promised, and that's what's sort of remarkable about him. When he promised, it sounded like it's going to be beneficial to Russia. But somehow, when we turn around, all of a sudden, instead of benefiting us, benefited his idea of the state.
Ukraine, symbolically and strategically the most important of these countries, is at the crossroads for the transit of Russian oil and gas to Europe. The Ukrainian presidential elections are in October 2004. The pro-Russian authoritarian regime is in difficulty. But Putin has no intention of letting Ukraine choose the path to democracy. The FSB and Putin's advisors collaborate closely with Ukrainian intelligence services to ensure the victory of Putin's protege, Viktor Yanukovych. At the climax of the election campaign, Viktor Yushchenko, the pro-Western candidate, is poisoned and badly disfigured. But this doesn't deter him or the Ukrainian people. On the 20th of December, after an agitated poll, the Orange Revolution leads him to victory.
For Putin, it is more than a failure. It's a humiliation. But there are other ways to show Ukraine that she will not escape from Russia's hold.
On the 1st of January 2006, the Kremlin cuts off the gas supplies to Ukraine.
This action was from the beginning intended to show the Ukraine and Europe how powerful Russia is in terms of its influence with regard to gas supplies.
But the Kremlin's blackmail has only just begun. Parliamentary elections are coming up, and Russia continues its intimidation by stopping the importation of Ukrainian goods. Putin's message is clear. The pro-Russian Yanukovych must become prime minister. If the Ukrainians vote for his party, everything will return to normal. Today, the deed is done. Yanukovych is prime minister, and Ukraine is moving away from Europe and NATO. In Ukraine, Putin demonstrates his capacity to use any means to transform a failure into victory.
Anything is indeed possible in Russia. But unpredictability never goes beyond these stairs. Within the secrecy of the Kremlin walls, the leader and his cabal control the state, the economy, and the destiny of the people. Vladimir Putin has succeeded in his mission. He has established the vertical of power, stabilized the economy, and made Russia an important player on the world stage again. Former KGB is more powerful than ever before in history. But what choice do the Russian people really have? Whatever Putin's regime be called, dictocracy or militocracy, his chosen successor will continue to perpetrate his system, privatizing the state with former members of the KGB, ignoring the rule of law and curbing freedom of thought. As for Russia's economic and diplomatic confrontation with the United States, its impact on the redivision of the world will concern not only the Russian people, but also the future of us all.
Someone like to look after the lights? Left and right, leave the middle one alone. Need I add any more? Habakkuk chapter 2. The vertical of power. Dictatorship, Gogian style, is already there in Russia. The KGB have control. You saw what he did to Ukraine? That's what he's going to do to Europe. We read of nowhere in the Bible that says that Russia will take Europe by storm or by warfare or by conquest. They don't need to. He laid himself with thick clay. But there is one area he will, or at least the Russians will take by conquest, as we shall see in a moment. But I've got to finish this off first. We haven't finished part one yet, so relax. Because there's a bit more to say. Remember this verse? Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of Magog. Gog the dictator, Magog his land, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, prophesy concerning him. You might think, but I'm going to say that Vladimir Putin is Gog. You're wrong. I don't believe he is Gog, and here are the reasons. He is of the land of Magog, and there, according to those who think they know, is the fullest extent of Magog. We would normally associate Magog with Germany, Central Europe. St. Petersburg, his birthplace, the place where he spent literally billions of dollars rebuilding the Tsarist's palaces, the Heritage Museum, reinterring the Tsars from where they were slaughtered in Central Russia and buried ignominiously by the Bolsheviks in 1917, brought them back and buried them in the Tsarist cemeteries in St. Petersburg, coated the city with gold. Why is he doing all that? He's re-establishing the Tsarist system. Because you see, the Russian Orthodox Church wants the Tsars back. Did you see Vladimir Putin standing beside the double-headed eagle? We'll talk more about that in a moment too. But the fact is, brethren and sisters and young people, he is not of the land of Magog. And Gog must be of his land. So here is the Tsarist family, slain by the Bolsheviks in 1917, as I said, in Central Russia. And now the Russians are converting all the heraldry of their army and their politics to the double-headed eagle. See this, the double-headed eagle? That comes from Constantinople. When it fell to the Turks in 1453, 1452 or 3, they had to go somewhere else. The Eastern Church had to find another place. And they went to Moscow. The Tsar of Russia said, we needed a religion. Come here, we'll take your religion. And so the Tsars adopted the double-headed symbol that came from Constantinople, the symbol of the Eastern Roman Empire. And now they are changing. Began this back in 2007, a process expected to last 3 years. They're changing the heraldry of 2,135 military units to these symbols, the double-headed eagle and the crown of the Tsars. That's going on right now. They're 2 years or more into that process. That is the double-headed eagle. Did you notice this below it? Guess what? This is Russia depicted as the man-child Michael riding a white horse and slaying the black dragon. They get that from Revelation chapter 12. That means that religion is back in control in Russia. Yeltsin and now Putin and now, of course, his successor, Medvedev, rely upon the support of the church. And the church wants the Tsars to come back. Now, not far south from here, no, southwest from here. In 1992, His Imperial Highness the Grand Duke Vladimir of Russia died in Miami, Florida, aged 74. He claimed to be the head of the House of Romanov, the Russian royal family name, and so the rightful emperor and autocrat of all the Russias. In purely genealogical terms, his claim seems straightforward enough, for he was undoubtedly the senior living descendant of Emperor Alexander II, who ruled Russia as Tsar from 1855 until 1881, when he was blown up in St. Petersburg by a bomb. He is survived by his wife and their daughter Maria, good Catholic name that, who was born in Madrid in 1953 and married in 1976, and this is where it becomes important. Maria, his daughter, the man who died in 1992, there he is, and here's his daughter Maria. She married Prince Franz Wilhelm of Prussia, read Germany, and they have a son. Did you know in history, brethren and sisters and young people, that the Russian royal family, the Tsars, invariably married into the German royal family? Did you know that Peter III had a wife called Catherine who poisoned him and got him out of the way because he was a nutter, and then took over the throne and became one of the most powerful rulers in Russia's history? They called her Catherine the Great. She was German. And that by the time that the Tsars left power under the Bolsheviks in 1917, that their bloodline was primarily German. They were three quarters German. Did you know that? Well, here's this guy, three quarters German. His daughter's three quarters German. She marries a German prince and they have a son. What does that make the son, do you think? 85, 90% German? Grand Duke Vladimir declared Grand Duchess Maria, this lady, the sole heiress to the throne, and caused further controversy in Russian royal circles by proceeding to create, quite unprecedentedly, his German son-in-law, this fellow, Franz Wilhelm, a Grand Duke. The Grand Duke's next in line to the throne. Grand Duke Vladimir foresaw the beginning of a new dynasty of Hohenzollern-Romanov. Hohenzollern, German royal family name. Romanov, Russian royal family name. Those two houses brought together. They have a son. That's interesting. Let's just read this again. Son of man, set thy face unto Gog of the land of Magog. The leader of Russia, Gog, has to have German origins. Now here is the Romanov family tree. Now there is the gentleman that we've been talking about who died in Miami. This line over here was wiped out. This is the family of Nicholas II, his wife Feodora, their five children, shot by the Bolsheviks in 1917. So now the line comes down here through Vladimir. There's his wife Leonida, she's still alive. There's his daughter Duchess Maria. She marries a German prince. They have a son. He was born in 1981. His name is Prince Georgi Romanov. There he is, as a grown man. What does that make him, by the way, the mathematicians in the audience? Born in 81. What's he now? 28. If Christ comes tomorrow, add 10 years for Armageddon. What's that make him? 38, 39, prime of life. Or you might say, well, yeah, maybe. You know what, brethren and sisters? Brother Thomas knew this in 1848. He wrote this in Opus Israel, page 432. A Tsar of Russia will be both Emperor of Germany and Autocrat of all the Russias. He wrote that because, you see, he didn't look at what was going on around him and say, oh, that's interesting, and interpret prophecy on the basis of what he saw with his eyes. He studied the Bible and interpreted what had to happen. There's a difference, isn't there? It doesn't matter if things go the wrong way. If you interpret prophecy correctly, it doesn't matter if temporarily it's not going the way you expect it to go. You just hold to your belief. It'll come back. And here is the proof. The dictatorship of Gog is there. All we need is a Tsar. And he's sitting there. He's waiting. And the church wants the Tsars back. Now for the troubles in the Middle East in the crescent of crisis as a precursor for Nebuchadnezzar's image formation. I've got to be quick on this. Ezekiel 38, 5-7 mentioned Persia, Ethiopia and Libya with them. So these are part of Gog's confederacy, along, of course, with the house of Togarmah, of whom we have spoken. Be thou prepared, says God to Gog, prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. The word guard there means a guard of a prison. Jesenius says a custodian. Lock them up under your control. Lade yourself with thick clay, get the European nations on board, and then conquer the territories that the Bible says you have to conquer. I want to talk about that. But before I do, I want to just go a little bit further south, west. I want to come down to here, to Sudan, because this is the modern nation that actually is the Kush, the southern Kush of the Bible. You aware of that? Most of the old Kush is not actually Ethiopia of today. It's a portion of it, as you can see. This Kush of the Bible is actually in the territory of modern Sudan. Have you ever wondered why in the last 10 years there's been a genocide going on there? You ever wondered why it's a government-sponsored genocide? You got people from Sudan in your country that have had to flee to go elsewhere? We got them in Australia. You ever wonder why this is happening? Well, it's happening for this reason. This is Bible prophecy being fulfilled before our very eyes. Government-sponsored genocide in the Darfur region on the western side where many Christians live has been going on now for 10 or 12 years, and hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered or chased away. This has made Sudan an international pariah, and their only allies in the world are Libya and Iran. And Ezekiel 38 verse 6 said, what did it say? You know what it said. Persia, Ethiopia, read modern Sudan, and what's the other one? You got them. Only friends that Sudan has, Libya and Persia or Iran. Okay? And this man can't go anywhere, really, without being under threat of being arrested and taken to the international court. Guess what he's done? He's the leader of Sudan. Iran and Sudan have just signed in Tehran a defence cooperation memorandum of understanding. So they're locking themselves together, exactly as we would expect from Ezekiel 38. Let me just take you back a step. Let me just remind you of Nebuchadnezzar's image and what it's really all about. We know, and we give lectures about this, that there were four world empires in history. There's the Babylonian, the head of gold, the Medo-Persian, the chest and arms of silver, the Grecian, the belly and thighs of brass, the Roman with its two legs, the iron empire. And then you've got the feet, part of iron, part of clay, a mixture of the remnant of the Roman Empire, its religion, Catholicism, with the seed of men, the clay of democracy and republicanism. And we are told in Daniel 2 how that would come about. Not because the clay mingled itself with the iron, read it carefully, Daniel 2:42, that the iron mingled itself with the clay. So the Roman Catholic Church would make advances towards democracy, towards the liberal approach of liberty, equality and fraternity. We've seen that happen. Okay, they're still rigid, they're still iron, but they've mingled themselves with the seed of men. That's the situation we had today. That's true, but that's not what Nebuchadnezzar's image is about. Nebuchadnezzar's image is about the latter days. Verse 28, there's a God in heaven. He reveals secrets. He makes known to King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. And then we read in verse 35, when the stone hits the feet, topples the image, begins to crush it, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together, which means that that image has got to be there in totality. This is not just about history. Babylon passing to Persia, Persia passing to Greece, Greece to Rome. This image has got to be there in toto. It's got to be complete. All the peoples that were once in the territories of Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, Rome have got to be brought together into one massive image empire in the days of these kings, our days. That's the Gogian Confederacy in other guise. Now, it's important to understand that, because I want to show you the territories of these empires. There's Babylon. There's Medo-Persia. See the red line? You'll notice it goes over to the Indus River or a bit beyond. I want you to just keep that in mind. Down here in Egypt as well. There's the Grecian. Over here began, of course, in Macedon. Alexander's victories, his triumphs were right over here to the east. He went as far as the Indus River. He took all of these countries, what we would call Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, up here actually, Afghanistan, and half of Pakistan. They were all part of Medo-Persia and Greece. Got a picture? What about the Roman Empire? Well, the Roman Empire, though it had a toehold on the Persian Gulf for a short while, in fact was driven back by these Parthians, these dreadful Parthians over here, the Iraqis. Okay? And the Parthians made life very difficult for the Romans, and Trajan's conquests east of the Euphrates were abandoned by Hadrian in AD 118. And he built a line of forts. Along that line you can see there, you can go there today, to modern Jordan, and you can actually see every Roman mile the ruins of a Roman fort. That was their boundary. What's that telling us? It's telling us that there's an area that the Roman Empire never possessed that was once possessed by the empires that preceded it. That's what's telling us. And Daniel 7 verse 7 says this. After this, and this is about the fourth beast, the Roman beast, the iron of the image, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth. There's your identifier. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the others, etc. What does it mean? It stamped the residue with the feet of it. Well, you see, it's about conquest. And the residue is that area. It can go right over here, in fact. It's that area you can see there. This was owned by the Medo-Persians and by Alexander the Great and his successors. It was never, ever controlled by Rome. And the fourth beast is the beast that Christ destroys. It says in Daniel 7 verse 11 that the body of that beast, the fourth beast, is burned, utterly destroyed. So the fourth empire is the last before the fifth empire, the kingdom of God. That's the residue that the fourth beast has to stamp with its feet. Now I wonder who is going to revive the fourth beast. Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? It's Russia. And Gog has to embrace into his territory this area here. Not by using the weight of pledges. It says stamping the residue with the feet of it. It's about control. It's about military operations. Well then, what's been happening here then? There's Afghanistan. Things have been happening in Afghanistan, haven't they? Have you wondered why? There's Pakistan. It's on fire. It's an ungovernable country right now. I wonder why. Here's Iraq. Americans know about that, don't they? They're bringing home boxes all the time with bodies in it. What about this crowd? They just had an election. Ahmadinejad's back. Making life very hard, isn't he? For America and many others, especially Israel. So why is all this happening, brethren and sisters? It's happening because Bible prophecy is about to be fulfilled. And Russia is going to take this area by conquest. Will you say, how do you know? Well, for one, the Bible says it, and two, they've already had a practice run, and they won't make the same mistake again. Russia came into Afghanistan, you'll remember, in the 1970s. Remember that? After 15 ignominious years of being defeated by a shabby lot of mujahideen, who, by the way, were armed by America, they got out. They lost 50,000 men and a whole heap of equipment, and they were utterly humiliated. They won't make the same mistake again. And if you were a Russian general who was involved in the 1970s and 80s, what would you do if you wanted to take Afghanistan again? You'd look back at history, you'd see the British in the 1800s, for them it was a disaster. You would look at your own history and say, no nation on earth, even Alexander the Great had trouble with them. You cannot take this people unless you take two mountain ranges. You have to take the mountain range that sits between Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's where they say the Al-Qaeda, the gentleman that America wants to kill, you know, the 9/11 guy, that's where he is. He's thumbing his nose at the Americans. He's safe up there in the mountains. He's got protection. And there's another mountain range over here between Afghanistan and Iran. If you were a Russian general, what would you do next time you came down into Afghanistan? I know what I'd do. It's pretty simple. You don't need to be Einstein to work this one out. You don't stop at the mountain range, do you? You take half of Pakistan. You come into Iran. You seize both sides of the mountain. And then you say, what are you going to eat now, fellas? And you starve them out. So you can see that happening, can't you? You can actually see what's going on here. And Bible prophecy is about to be fulfilled. And when this happens, brethren and sisters, and Russia's already shown us what they do, when this happens, the Indians who had people from this very area come in and shoot them up in Bombay a few months ago, you recall that? They're very touchy about Pakistan, aren't they? They've both got nuclear weapons. What do you reckon the Indians are going to do when Russia does, as the Bible says it will do, stamp the residue of its feet and takes the territory once possessed by Alexander and the Medo-Persians up to the Indus River? Do you think the Indians are going to say, oh, well, you know, we're not really interested in the rest of Pakistan up to the Indus. You can have it, Russia. Or will the Indians move up to the Indus and Pakistan disappear altogether? And won't we then have the biblical Eastern Tarshish, who will throw its lot in with Britain? You notice I didn't mention America. With Britain, the Tarshish powers. Won't that be the case? Is it not true that India is the greatest and the largest naval power in the Indian Ocean right now? It is. Once pro-Russian, used to buy Russian warships once. Not anymore. Now swinging towards the West. Now for the third part of our update. The one that's affecting your wallets, perhaps in some cases. The great financial crash of 2008. What next?